This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Boop. Beep. Beep boop. Catchy jingle? We need a catchy jingle.
Catchy jingle. This is the part where we put in the jingle. Snappy, snappy words and songs. Makes you want to buy these products. La, 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 la. You know it's a fun product?
What?
Socks.
Socks. Oh my God. I mean, but who wears socks these days? Nobody wears socks.
A lot of people.
I don't believe it. Do not believe
it.
Oh yeah, name one.
There's a Venn diagram out there. If I did a Venn diagram of people who wear socks and people who like space, that little sliver in the middle of pure joy and happiness, that's sciencesocks.com right there.
sciencesocks.com. Is there like a special link that people should go to?
Sure is. It's called sciencesocks.com/nerd. That's sciencesocks.com/nerd for all your socks and spacey nerdiness needs. One-stop shop. Ba-bam. I know what you're thinking, Kavi.
What am I thinking?
I have earlobes with holes in them that I like to stuff little sparkly things into, like earrings. What you got for me now, Science Socks?
I mean, that's perfect because Science Socks has like the perfect things to shove in your tiny ear holes. They have James Webb Space Telescope tiny things that you can shove in your ear holes. They have Mars Lander things that you can shove in your ear holes. They even have, get this, they even have space shuttle shaped bits of meteorite that you can shove in your ear holes. Tell me where else you're going to find that.
Head to toe, Science Socks has literally got you covered. It's fantastic.
It's wild. Although I wouldn't say head to toe. I would say head and toe. Nothing in between.
Well, they do have a really cool umbrella that looks like the parachute for the Perseverance of the rover, which you hold with your hand, which is middle-ish, but then it's over your head. Look, whatever. Go to sciencesocks.com/nerd. sciencesocks.com/nerd. And if you purchase anything from that URL, 10% of all proceeds go to STEM programs to help kids learn science.
Amazing. 10% of your purchase could be going to a STEM charity. Fantastic. I love it. Makes me happy.
All right, everyone. Hope you visit that shop. Enjoy and many cozy footwearings to you.
You are listening to a Science Actually production.
One small step for Neil, but it's a heck of a big leap for me.
Except
that we sure have a nice
flying
machine here.
Yes, sir, Bruce.
Figure out what the windows are
hanging
while I'm up there.
Is a podcast, I mean, is it a visual podcast? Is there...
It's going to be on YouTube and TikTok, so people will see you. And
okay.
I shave. And then it's also going to be on... wherever.
So did I. No, I'm kidding. That's pretty cool.
I'm very much in need of a shave, so don't worry about that. And you have that lovely space background behind you. What is that? Is that a nebula?
That's just a piece of cloth. Sorry to disabuse you.
She's not actually in space, Kavi. I'm sorry.
Michael's hobby shop or something. I don't know what it is. Yeah, stars, Milky Way, maybe.
I love it. Space cloth. Space cloth. And Emily, it looked like the person who just walked past you was wearing a Star Trek uniform.
No, he's not. We have a pretty lax office dress code, so we can wear whatever we want. I'm wearing a Stevie Nicks shirt today, so yeah. Nice. So we have a pretty flexible dress code and stuff. We had a sort of an office party, so if you hear any noise in the background, I think some people are still reveling for some reason. So I apologize.
Way, no worries at all. I mean, here I am wearing a piece of the cloth that Bruce has hanging behind him.
Say, where did you get that?
It is, yeah, space cloth.
Oh yeah, it does look like a Star Trek uniform. I saw that briefly as a web file. That looked good. That looked good.
Like exactly.
Maybe
one day.
It is. So you don't know.
Oh, on a holodeck, it all makes sense.
Holodeck is awesome. Anyway, everyone, welcome everybody to the episode of The Nerd and the Scientist. And today we have two special guests, Emily Carney and Bruce McCandless III. They just released the new book, Starbound, and it's pretty much about the evolution of the space program from the very first person to build the little rocket all the way up to sending people to space today. Emily is an accomplished writer and space historian and founder of Space Hipsters, a very popular community with tens of thousands of people who know astronauts, apparently. Every time I look in, there's astronauts, and I'm jealous beyond jealous. And Bruce is an author and historian, and also the son of the legendary Bruce McCandless II, who set the gold standard for the coolest photo in space ever. That's it. If you've ever seen a picture of a guy floating completely unconnected to anything in space with just a little jetpack, that's his dad. Welcome to the show, both of you. So, quick question: which space shuttle was the biggest?
Which space shuttle was the biggest?
Let's go.
I'm going to say Discovery was, because it took the Hubble Space Telescope up.
Great answer. I would guess Discovery, because it carried some pretty large payloads, maybe Columbia. Columbia had the biggest butt. I know that much. Don't ask me why I know this.
which part of the shuttle is the butt? I'm sorry.
The with the mains, it was a little back heavy from what I've heard. Don't ask why I know this. A shuttle astronaut actually told me this. I was like, okay. I guess it's how it
answers Atlantis. Atlantis is longer, wider, and heavier than all of them.
The one we didn't, the one no one mentioned. Okay.
Yeah.
Nope.
All right, you've humiliated us already, Benjamin.
No, I actually looked it up just before we started. I knew one of them was slightly big. It's like slightly bigger.
Yeah.
I knew that one of them was bigger.
I figured it was a few feet bigger.
I had to look it up
maybe.
And just thought it'd be funny.
To make you feel a bit better, Bruce, that photo, the untethered photo that Benjamin was just referring to, I was using that this week to teach physics undergrads about conservation of momentum and how, what do you do if you're untethered in space and you're floating away from the spaceship? I'll see, do either of you have a suggestion for what to do to get back to the spaceship?
If you're floating away from the spaceship, and the power sort of, in other words, you've received some sort of impetus. It's not continuing. You've just been shoved and you're moving away. Well, you know, I've heard if you had your back to the spaceship, you could try to throw something and push yourself back that way. But if you're facing the shuttle and you throw something, that's not going to
it's gonna not help you.
But I mean maybe that works in theory. I think it'd be awful hard to do in practice as you're screaming.
No, that was the exact example that I gave the students, because they were given a question that was similar of, you know, if you if you're in a boat in the middle of a lake and suddenly you realize that your oars have been eaten by piranhas. And you have a bunch of gear and you have some friends with you, what can you do to get back to shore? And then the only real answer is to like throw your gear in the opposite direction to the shore. So yeah, it's exactly that.
I went straight to throw your friends off the boat in the opposite direction. The gear. Throw the gear off. Yeah. Yes.
I would have gotten very dystopian with my answer, unfortunately. So yeah.
Or your friends. And I are riders, so we don't really have friends. So that's
yeah, exactly.
Option we don't have.
We live in our heads a lot. So yeah, throw the whole friend group away. Just throw them off the boat. I'm kidding. Oh my God.
Just keep the tasty one. Keep the tasty one. And then throw the rest of them off, overboard.
So speaking of writing, like, I am so curious as to how the two of you got connected to write this book together, what the impetus was for Starbound, and how you decided, like, what... There's so much, as Benjamin just mentioned, crammed in from the history of spaceflight. So how did it all come together? What did you decide to include or not? Tell us about that.
Yeah, go ahead, Emily, if you want to jump in there.
Yeah, I'll start. Well, I've known Bruce for probably like 5 or 6 years, I'm guessing now. Bruce came to Space Hipsters a few years ago because it's kind of, the group has been steadily just growing and growing over probably the past, 15 years. I should know this. Mm-hmm. But I met him through Hipsters a few years ago, and he was working on the book that he wrote about his father, Wonders All Around, which I'm a little biased because I helped proofread the book, but I highly recommend it. It's awesome. But I probably like 2.5 years ago, I was talking to Bruce, you know, we're just in, you know, I kind of expressed an interest in, you know, I need to write a book. Like, I've written probably thousands of articles about spaceflight, but I need to actually like buckle down and write an actual book. And Bruce was like, well, I'm working on a manuscript now. We could work on it together. And I was like, that sounds awesome, because I'm not just saying this because we did a book together, but I think Bruce is an amazing writer. I think Wonders All Around is really an excellent book, you know, so I really, like I said, I'm probably a little biased, but I really loved it. I thought it was a great testament to, like, you know, his father and just what it was like to grow up during that time, et cetera. So we started writing on Starbound. As far as like the content and how we sort of divided it up, we wanted to write sort of a narrative, like a history of U.S. spaceflight, but Bruce will probably bring this up in his answer, but there's this book that Colin Burgess, the Australian space historian, wrote about the Soviet space program. And it really was quite enjoyable, you know, in explaining their program. It wasn't too academic, or it wasn't too, like, you know, it wasn't boring, basically. And we sort of modeled our book on his, in a way. We didn't copy off of him, but we sort of modeled the idea. But as far as the work in Starbound, you know, we wanted to write sort of a narrative about U.S. space history. But at the same time, we wanted to focus a lot on the people. We didn't want to just focus on, you know, dates and mechanical stuff. You know, people love that stuff, too. But we wanted to make it have a human touch to it. And we tried to include a lot of things that, you know, are kind of, you should know about U.S. spaceflight. But at the same time, we included some deep cuts in there, which I really am happy about. That's kind of the stuff that I love. You know, we sort of included, Bruce is going to roll his eyes here, but sort of the mid-70s weird period in between time, you know, where you had futurists talking about, we're going to have colonies in space. It's going to be awesome. We're going to have communes in space, y'all, you know, and just weird stuff like that. That's kind of a weird outlier in space. Yeah, kind of strange outliers in space history that are sort of more deep cuts that aren't, you don't usually see them in, you know, books about U.S. space history, because it's something that's sort of almost niche in a way. So I hope that answers the question, but that's kind of how we structured, you know, the book and the writing of it. And we wanted to put sort of these little pop culture nods in the book. We have a few lists in there about, like, you know, favorite songs, favorite movies, favorite astronauts, although that was like trying to select your favorite child. We have a list in there that we'll probably regret, called our space predictions. So, yeah, we have that
they're
list.
They're all wrong. Spoiler, they're all wrong.
They probably will be all wrong at some point, but that's okay. You know, we tried to make the book Yeah, so I hope that answers the question, but that's really how we got to work with it. But yeah, we wanted to do something about U.S. space history, but we didn't want it to just be sort of a dry, you know, beginning, middle, end type of thing, if that makes sense. So, Bruce?
Yeah, Emily's lying about all that stuff.
Oh, Rob.
We met in prison.
Okay.
We met because we're freaks about Skylab. That's how it started. I thought I had some sort of weird perverted love for Skylab, but it turns out there are others who share the perversion. And you know, Skylab was this bastard program. Someone said it was made up of murdered Apollo, you know, parts from the murdered Apollo program.
Right.
And it was crazy because it was an attempt to sort of create a 70s habitat in space. You know, after we'd seen this very sort of structured militaristic space program in the past, and you know, they put a shower in Skylab, and they were talking about entertainment options. They were going to put an entertainment console in Skylab, and you know, they did exercising and ran around the orbital workshop and grew these funky beards and mustaches, and it was just a funny program, and I get endless amounts of enjoyment reading about it, and Emily's one of the top scholars on Skylab stuff, and we sort of bonded about that. And one day she sent me something she'd found in some very obscure archives that was written by an Australian fellow named Phil Chapman, who was an American astronaut. And it was basically a memo he wrote to his fellow astronauts back in 70. Very late 70. And he says, guys, we are screwed, man, because we're coming to the end of Apollo and no one's going to care what we do after that because it was so big and great. And the country's going down the tubes. And, you know, so we need to really double down on the science part of Skylab so people take us seriously. And it's a great, great sort of insight into what was going on at NASA at the time. And we bonded further over that. And, you know, one thing led to another, and we started working on this book. And as Emily said, Colin Burgess had written this very elegant but entertaining book about the Soviet space program. We thought we'd try to do something similar. We completely failed. Our book is big and sloppy, and it's got all kinds of extraneous facts and back alleys in it. But nevertheless, Colin was our inspiration, and we tried to do something similar for the American space program that he did for the Soviets.
That's awesome.
Go on.
No,
I think that's the genesis, and we've been real pleased. It's selling pretty well. We've got some great media, you know, reviews. We're not getting as many reader reviews as we hoped. My thesis is people sort of sit down and start reading, get to Apollo, finish that, and they're like,
"That's it, I'm done."
Yeah, everything that happened. I don't. Maybe they skipped the Skylab or the shuttle chapter, we'd like to get some more reader responses out there to go along with the, you know, we got a nice note from Publishers Weekly and from the Library Journal and that sort of thing.
Going along with you guys loving all those little fun backstories, anecdotes and everything, I love hearing those types of stories, like Yuri Gagarin peed on the tire of the bus that brought him from launch pad, and now every single cosmonaut to this day still does
has
it.
Has to do it.
Or Young ate brought a sandwich up on
Gemini. I still do it. What are you talking about?
I can't have a bus to go on.
Me too. No, I'm kidding.
I guess I'm
for good luck.
In San Francisco, it's part of it's what you do. And Young brought a corned beef sandwich up on one of the Gemini flights. I forget which one. What's a good story like that? Gemini 3. Oh, I bet you're right.
What's a good story like that?
What's a good story like that?
You know. I've been reading about Ed White a little bit because we're coming up on the anniversary of his spacewalk, and one thing that was kind of weird is that when he and McDivitt were up there in Gemini 4, they saw something they couldn't figure out what it was, and it turned out to be a military presumably American military spy satellite, you know, so there was a lot of back and forth about, oh, what did they see? I'm not sure they were supposed to see it. I'm sort of tracking that down, that little
going down that rabbit trail now, because I think it's, you know, the U.S. has always been very secretive about its spies, its sort of network of spy satellites. And I think this was probably an early breach of protocol that these guys were up there and said, "Hey, I see you. Hey, there's something else up here. And it's spiking. It's got big arms." And you know, the news sort of disappears after that very first day it's reported. So I'm kind of tracking that down. I'd like to see what it was.
That would be hysterical. Oh,
gosh. I think we're coming up on 15 minutes, but as far as the weird stories that are in the book, I really like the Suicide Squad story. I thought that was really cool just because you don't always hear about it. I thought that was interesting. You know, sort of the genesis of JPL was these guys just doing crazy stuff, you know? And that was the genesis of, you know, what we know now is, you know, very sort of this very academic, you know, kind of almost a Tweety, like, you know, you associate JPL with these missions like, you know, Voyager and stuff like that, which are very, you know, have a long heritage and really a long record of science. You know, I mean, Voyager's God, almost my age. It's older than I am slightly, you know, and I'm getting up there, you know. Yeah. So I love stuff like that. Bruce has already mentioned this. I'm going to keep this brief because if I talk about this, we're going to be here for 5 hours. And nobody wants that. Okay. Of course, the Skylab stuff, just because a lot of books, you know, there is a one fine standalone on it. Or there's a few good books on it, but David Hitt wrote a really magnificent book on it. But you don't see it written a lot about, you know, I mean, a few of us have tried to close the gap, but you just don't see a lot of literature about it, or factual literature about it. And some of the activities that happened during the 9 months. So those are probably among my favorite parts, I would say.
Wasn't there like a mutiny once on Skylab?
Oh God, no.
We don't talk about the mutiny.
did I just trigger? Oh, I triggered. Cause their schedule was like, it was like written down 24/7 to the minute and they didn't have any time to think. And they eventually just turned off the radio or something.
Yeah, no, they didn't turn off the radio. I'll keep this very brief, but no, but basically they had Apollo lunar landing schedules, and they were, you know, they were doing a 3 month or 4 month, 84 day, you know, they're doing an 84 day mission. You can't really have that. You know, that's not how you can manage people during a very long mission. And unfortunately, you know, mission control and the crew both had to learn how to manage that, you know, and it's actually a very positive story. There wasn't a mutiny or a strike as reported. And it really contributed towards, you know, the shuttle program later. So that's the short version of it. I've done interviews where I've talked about this for hours. So I'll shut up.
Okay. That's given me so many questions that I want to ask about, I mean, especially like this idea of just like the early JPL blowing stuff up. But we'll come back to that. We have to stop for a second to mention the sponsor for this week's episode, which I feel like you guys would actually really appreciate. So our sponsor for this season is sciencesocks.com. They basically make space-themed socks and space-themed jewelry, and they have JWST earrings, and they have necklaces that are made out of like actual meteorite from some meteorite that crashed into Earth near Sweden.
Yep.
Oh wow.
And they carved them into little space shuttles. They'd like little meteorite
carved
space shuttle necklace and earrings. It's crazy.
It's so cool. One of our predictions has to do with you know, the mining of asteroids and getting ready for asteroid you know, earrings made out of asteroid substances and that sort of thing. And I think that'll happen in the next, well, you gotta read the book.
Okay. Read the book, everybody.
I love this. We're combining an ad for the book and an ad for the science books together in one. This is peak.
This
is it. Peak capitalism. I love it.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a super cool website. I highly recommend folks to check it out. And if you go to sciencesocks.com/nerd, 10% of your purchase will go towards a donation to a STEM charity. So highly recommended. And you'd be proving Bruce's prediction right if you buy those meteorite earrings.
Start now to prove the book right in the future.
Yes, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I love it. Getting back to our questions, the thing that I wanted to ask you was, when you mentioned the kind of early history of JPL, it reminded me of this book that I just read by Malcolm Gladwell, The Bomber Mafia. And he was talking in that about the mentality of the bomber squad that, you know, ended up being responsible for a lot of the high altitude, high precision, or attempted high precision bombing campaigns in World War II. And he was saying that when the kind of Air Corps tactical school that was responsible for their kind of ethos and their modus operandi, that tactical school was basically like the Wild West. They were like, you know, it's a poor pun, but they were flying by the seats of their pants because they had no idea what they were doing. They were just kind of moving fast and breaking things. And I'm so curious, like, from both of your expertise and looking at the history of spaceflight, like, what happens that causes an institution that is necessarily winging it to develop like really strict guidelines and practices?
Well, death of astronauts. I mean, that's the easiest way to. I mean, not the most pleasant way to say it, but the easiest way to say it. You know, after Apollo 1, there was a significant increase in the amount of attention paid to engineering of NASA spacecraft, and after the you know, after the Challenger disaster, a lot of people tell you NASA's whole sort of ethos changed, and it hasn't been the same agency ever since. It's been it went from sort of a go-go aggressive agency to one that is maybe too cautious. I mean, that's certainly something that my father felt and wrote about it at times. That's my that's my hot take on it. I mean, I think also you know, people with the agency who have accomplished things maybe get a little conservative and are jealous of protecting their accomplishments and not having the agency screw things up and therefore tarnish their legacy. There may be some of that involved as well.
Fair enough. Emily, do you have anything to add on this? Yeah.
Not much. I mean, other than what Bruce said, you know, he said the death of astronauts. I would have said, you know, failures. You know, failures. Nobody likes to see their expensive thing explode. You know,
right.
So, you know, probably, you know, that is, you know, that as well. You know, as well as, you know, the human error. You know, the human risk as well.
Hmm. Yeah. No, that's fair.
Yeah, is that an answer? That gets us into some sensitive territory, but that's sort of my feeling. And you know, NASA has to deal with that image a lot these days, especially when you've got a company like SpaceX. You know, that's got a great record. Don't get me wrong with regard to astronaut safety, but an agency that's perfectly willing to, a company that's perfectly willing to build things and blow them up and in pursuit of a better rocket. I was down in South Texas just a couple weeks ago watching one of the Starship launches. This was the one on March 6th or 7th, and launch was great, and the booster catch was great, but they managed to blow up another Starship somewhere over Florida, I think. Emily, yep. I don't know if you saw that, but
I saw a little bit of it outside. It was kind of weird because I'm like, what is that?
Yeah.
It was my birthday. I watched it. It was
oh, wow. You got some... Never mind. I almost said, you got a candle.
I watched it online from California. I wasn't there. But still.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping they'd hit the trifecta, you know, launch, catch, and a successful trip around the world for Starship. But I think they'll get there.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. There's kind of a need to be innovative. And the innovation is often tied to trying, you know, new things out and taking risks. But you obviously, as you said, you have to balance that with the safety of the people who work for you and the people in the immediate surroundings of, you know, testing.
Yeah, and start, you know, SpaceX, I mean, they sooner or later, they're going to get to that intersection where they have to balance their willingness to take chances against astronaut safety and the question is, will they be the same company? And I mean, don't get me wrong, I think they've done amazing things. I hope they continue to do amazing things. But, you know, Starship is looking like it might be a little harder than anyone thought. You know, just because they've been so successful for the last, you know, 10, 12 years.
But in the beginning, with the very first three attempts at reusable boosters, there was failure after failure after failure as well. I think Elon said that after the first three attempts, they all blew up. And if they were going to miss the fourth, that would have been the end of SpaceX. And luckily, that's the one that
right. That's when they were out on the Marshall Islands, right? And they were right. they were trying to send up their first Dragon, not the Dragon, right. The Falcon. It was the Falcon yeah. 1, right? Is that what they were calling it back then? And they were basically on an island full of crabs, and they had three misses, and they were down to their last card, basically. Yeah. So, I mean, amazing story. I really enjoyed seeing the launch. It was very, very cool.
NASA has this long history of just legends and folklore and just heroes galore for decades. And now the next hot thing is SpaceX with newer rockets and Blue Origin they just tried New Glenn not too long ago, and they're doing their little touristy things going up and down, so they're getting a lot of popularity. Do you feel like SpaceX and Blue Origin and any other comers, Virgin Galactic, say, are going to be wrapped into the one long great story of spaceflight, or are they kind of stealing some of NASA's thunder, as it were?
Emily, you want to
personally, this is more of a gut answer than probably a factual answer, but I don't think anybody can take any credit from NASA whatsoever. You know, what they've done in the last almost, 70 years, you know, it's just been nothing short of incredible. They went from, you know, not being able to put anything in space to, not only sending humans to the moon, but also helping to pioneer long-term space travel, and also launching a pretty impressive, albeit flawed, partially reusable spacecraft, the Space Shuttle, which, you know, despite all the flaws that we know about it, it's still a pretty amazing program. You know, I mean, it launched Hubble, it launched a lot of other satellites that really revolutionized spaceflight in the 80s, 90s, beyond. I could sit here and name a bunch of them. So I don't think anybody can take credit from NASA, past, present, or future at all. I think they'll be, as a historian, it's hard for me to say, because this is all unfolding as we speak. You know, a lot of stuff is going down right now. It's overwhelming almost, because it feels like every day there's something new. But I think, you know, hopefully it'll be looked at chronologically, you know, sort of as a, you know, as sort of a building up to something, but also, you know, sort of individually, like these different, you know, contractors and different agencies all, you know, contributed to, you know, pioneering spaceflight in their own ways.
So, yeah, Emily, you were saying that it'll really be something that we'll have to see kind of with the perspective of history to understand, like, just how pivotal NASA's role has been.
Yeah, and it's a very changing situation right now with all that's going on. You know, you got SpaceX that really has proven themselves to be a huge leader in the last, you know, decade plus. And now you got Blue Origin, you know, with the New Glenn coming up and things like that. Their capabilities are increasing. So a lot of this remains to be written, I suppose.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough. And Bruce, did you want to add anything to that answer?
Yeah, so the question, as I understand it, is how will the activities of private space companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, Rocket Lab, et cetera, you know, play into this broader tale about our expansion into space, and will NASA be eclipsed? And I do worry about that happening, and I worry because our present administration doesn't seem all that interested in what NASA has increasingly come to see as its core mission, which is science. and learning about you know, not only the planet and the solar system, but further out as well. You know, yeah, I mean, SpaceX is great, and you know, they'll be doing some important commercial work, maybe going to, you know, taking us to moon and to the moon and possibly even to Mars at some point. You know, there are a lot of people excited about the commercial possibilities of going to the moon and maybe mining asteroids, and maybe, you know, again, going to Mars. But NASA and ESA does this a lot too. They're interested in some bigger questions, and I think that's super important. And you know, we're getting some information all of a sudden back. All of a sudden, I think from the Euclid probe, which I believe is primarily an ESA project, about unbelievable, almost incomprehensible things like the nature of dark matter, which some scientists are saying data indicates may be evolving, and getting into questions about, you know, whether Einstein's cosmological constant is what we think it is, and you know, those questions are way beyond me, but fortunately they're not way beyond others, maybe you, Kobe, I don't know, but you know, they get into really important matters about, you know, who we are and where we came from and where the universe is going, and I worry that that maybe some American politicians may not take that seriously enough and allow NASA to fall behind in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The work that myself and other astronomers and astrophysicists do is so dependent on the data that we can get to understand the universe, to understand the universe at different wavelengths. And a lot of that data cannot be obtained here on Earth. You know, like there is optical light and some radio light, a little bit of infrared light, but the rest of the electromagnetic spectrum does not make it down through our atmosphere, right? So these space-based missions are pivotal to, exactly as you said, to studying the universe and the cosmos and answering these sorts of fundamental questions. And what's frustrating for me, and this is kind of leading into a question, is that these missions take years, or in some cases decades, to plan and build and launch, and then they'll spend you know, similar amounts of time in space returning data. How does that work when we have a four-year political cycle that will determine the priorities of, you know, like budgetary allocation? Is this something that requires more input from private funders or industry? Is this something that maybe we need to be looking outside of NASA to, like you mentioned, Bruce, the ESA, or to, you know, organizations overseas? Like, how do you, I know, Emily, you mentioned that, you know, you're a historian, so you can't really judge things as they're unfolding, but where do you see the future of the kind of scientific side of space exploration?
Okay, that's
sorry, it's a big question.
That's a great question. I don't want to. I'm trying to come on. I want to come up with an. I have an answer, but I'm afraid it'll be. I don't want it to sound too negative. Obviously, at the moment we have a political regime that's not very fond of science in the United States. I do have, you know, and we, you know, we've gone through similar things, probably not as extreme, I'm guessing, in the past, you know, during the 70s, when I think when Carter came in, you know, there were a lot of concerns that he would cancel the shuttle program and everything that went along with it, because I think he canceled a plane also. So there was a lot of talk like, God, if we don't, you know, land Enterprise correctly, the shuttle program's over type of thing. And all that, you know, science that we're planning for the shuttle is going to go away as well. So it's always, in the United States, it's always been contingent on whichever president is in the office and what they like and what they see as important, et cetera, et cetera. What the, you know, or what Congress or the Senate thinks is important, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I don't know, sort of going along with what Bruce says, I mean, I don't know. I'm afraid there will be a lot of science cuts. You know, I do look towards ESA. As Bruce was saying, Euclid just made some incredible returns. I just found out about that today, and I was like, whoa, I didn't know about it. And one of my friends at work asked me about it. I was like, that's really cool, you know? I think, you know, ESA has always had sort of a different mission than NASA. I think, you know, ESA's mission wasn't, you know, let's get guys on the moon, let's beat the Soviets. You know, ESA's mission was, let's establish science for the betterment of humanity, almost, from starting in the 50s, you know, because they started in a certain, they weren't ESA, but they were, they started back then, basically, if you look at their history, you know this. But yeah, I think, you know, it might, I hate saying this, you know, it might fall to other nations for the, you know, the next few years, which doesn't thrill me, but you know, it is what it is. It does, I think JWST, I want to say, is a collaboration between several countries. So hopefully that'll save it, you know, somewhat, so it won't fall victim to anything. And also Hubble. Hubble is NASA and ESA as well. And it's still going. I mean, it's been up there for 35 years. But I just did the math because I'm like 1990. God, that's incredible. You know, it's still making returns. I mean, yeah, it's probably not in the greatest shape, but it's still making, you know, returns after all this time. You know, it's not broken or anything. So,
it's still extremely competitive for scientists to get time on it because it's high quality data that's, you know, better than what you can get almost anywhere else on the planet or off the planet.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's still a workhorse. Go on, Bruce.
No, I think that Kobe, and so, you know, scientists around the world can use Hubble. I mean, if they get the proposal approved and they're doing good science. And that's the case, I think, with JWST. Is it as competitive to get on JWST or more competitive?
It's more competitive, yeah.
Yeah. Well, just to get back to your question about science and space exploration, is it possible private individuals could step up and help out? It is possible. I mean, we've had... you know, some very rich people who are primarily interested in transportation. But that's not to say that we could have equally wealthy individuals who become interested in fundamental scientific questions who fund, you know, development of something like, you know, the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope or Vera C. Rubin, something like that. You know, Bill Gates is interested in vaccinations. You know, maybe someone will step up and say, hey, I've got $3 billion and I'm interested in dark matter. You know, I will say we've got several instruments studying dark matter and dark energy now. In fact, I'm not even sure how they overlap exactly, but there is hope. I mean, Peter Beck at Space Lab has decided he wants to mount some sort of mission to Venus, for no apparent, profitability reason. Remains to be seen why he does it. I do hate to see NASA give up its place as sort of the pioneer of space science. And, it's such a tremendous, pays so much tremendous benefits to us, not only in terms of what we find out, but how we impress the rest of the world. You know, we say in our book that, you know, international influence doesn't necessarily come through the barrel of a gun, but maybe through the lens of a telescope. And if we can make American technology like Hubble and JWST available to the world, then we're making friends and we're influencing people, hopefully. And I hate to see us give that up to the Chinese or even to our friends in the ESA.
Although I love my friends at ESA, but or at ESA, I love them.
Although if we give it up, we might as well give it up to them. Yeah,
I love them. It's not a diss, but still, I agree with Bruce said. It would be a shame if NASA sort of looked at it sort of like the pioneers. You know, when people see that, just the logos, people are like, wow, that's NASA, you know, and stuff like that. You know, there's sort of a prestige that goes with it. So, yeah, I think that's what Bruce is trying to get at. There's a certain message that comes with, you know, that we're top of the line in science and technology.
NASA is a great name. I was gonna name my sons NASA, but I ended up having daughters, so it didn't work.
I've not heard this story. Wow. Instead.
She's real.
Sorry.
Anyway. Okay, so right. I think we've exhausted our seriousness quotient here.
All right,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Good. Sorry about that.
I'm down to
all right, let's have one fun question before we jump into our rapid fire thing at the end.
Lightning round. Okay.
All right. It's a fun, lighthearted one. What is one space artifact or mission patch that each of you finds like deeply moving?
Space artifact or mission patch?
Or well, photograph. I would say photograph, but that's kind of a gimme.
It's not really a space artifact. I have a photograph of my dad's class, astronaut class, group 5, and it's signed by all of them but one. And I don't know. My dad had that up in his study as I was growing up, and I've got it now. I'd say that's probably my favorite space-related artifact.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So nice. I can show it to you if you want.
What about you, Emily?
Oh, yeah, boy.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. I don't have mine next to me right now. It's at home. But I don't know how to explain this. I'm going to get in so much. I have a signed bedpost from astronaut Al Warden.
Nice.
That's probably my favorite artifact. It was a joke present, but I do have a signed bedpost from Al Warden. It says, "I slept on this bed," signed Al Warden, something like that. And it's literally a bedpost that's like been sanded on both ends. I had to carry it around for the whole day. I got it, and everybody was like, "Why do you have furniture with you?" And I was like, "Oh, Al Warden gave it to me." I told Vance Brand, you know, astronaut Vance Brand, Bruce knows who this is.
Oh yeah, sure.
Vance Brand was like, "Why do you have furniture with you?" And I was like, "Your colleague Al Warden gave it to me." And Vance started laughing. I was like, "Oh my God." So yeah, so that's probably I have a lot of artifacts that are pretty neat, but that's probably my number one artifact. So yeah.
No, that's special. Yeah.
Some sort of space story.
Oh, yeah. Something. Oh, wow.
Oh, wicked awesome.
Yeah, there's there's so cool. Bruce McCandless down
that's
there.
That's amazing.
Me.
Me.
Love that.
Anyway.
It's cool.
I like keeping that around.
Well, for folks who are just listening to this episode, you have incentive now to go onto YouTube or TikTok to see that and freeze frame and try to look and see if you can identify all the different astronauts there. Wow. So, so cool.
That is cool.
All right. So we have now a rapid fire round that we're going to try to do 11 questions in 5 minutes.
So oh, God. Go, okay.
Didn't we just go
back and forth?
I think we just did one, didn't we?
That was a fun one. It was more a conversational one. This one's quick and fast and kind of funny.
Yeah. Okay. First thing that comes to your head, rapid fire answers.
You realize I'm the dumbest person you've ever had on your show, so please just, that's
no.
The handicap.
I don't know. I've been on every single
zero
one of them.
For 11.
Surely not. All right. So I will say whoever can answer this fastest gets the question, and then we'll go back and forth. So you don't both have to answer it unless you have something. Yeah, okay. What is the weirdest thing that you believed as a kid?
That my parents were always right.
Love it. Perfect answer. All right, Benjamin, next one.
Next question. Which teacher had the biggest positive impact on you?
Mr. O'Donnell, probably in high school. He was a history teacher. Why is that wrong?
Mr. O'Donnell's awesome.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. Which scientific discovery do you wish you could have witnessed in person?
Oh, wow. Scientific discovery. I guess it would be seeing those plumes of material being ejected from, what was it, Io, when Voyager was out, going past the moons of, I'm going to say Jupiter. I hope I got the right planet. Mm-hmm.
It was Jupiter, I think.
But I think that would have been, I mean, I guess I'm a little space centric here, but I think that would have been super cool. because you know, sort of unexpected, and it brings up this idea that you know all these objects in the solar system have these lives of their own, these sort of tectonic and in some cases volcanic lives of their own. And it was like I liken it to walking into a room full of stuffed heads on the wall, you know, animals mounted on the wall, and looking around, and all of a sudden seeing one blinking and thinking, oh my god, you know,
it's sentient.
Yeah, I mean, also, yeah. You know, Galileo discovering the moons around Jupiter, that would have been pretty cool. Although I don't think they bathed very much back then, so maybe keeping it in the 20th century would be good.
All right, that works. Well, speaking of Galileo, if you had to pick one historical scientist to go bowling with, who would it be?
Oh, no. I know what this... Okay, I got an answer, even though he probably wasn't a great bowler. Gerard K. O'Neill. We're going to talk about space. Oh, she loves that guy. I love him. Yeah, we're going to talk about space habitats while bowling. Yeah, that's what we're doing. Although I doubt he would like bowling, but yeah, that's what I would choose. Maybe a second.
I'd do an Einstein. I mean, I'm pretty sure I could beat Einstein because he was kind of a small guy. I would bet Einstein I could beat him, and I bet I could. I think I could probably take some money off that guy.
He was a bit of a prankster and a jokester too. He would have had a good time.
Nice. All right. If you were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be? Go.
Bruce.
Grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese. Oh, that was awesome.
I think about that a lot, actually.
These are the questions that scientists really care about, not dark matter.
Or sandwich. What is your most controversial opinion about pizza?
Oh.
Okay, that green olives belong on pizza.
Heck yes.
I've gotten in arguments about this. Not the I could care. Pineapple goes either way, but some people have an insane hatred of green olives.
Is that controversial? I've never met anyone who didn't like green olives on pizza.
People who don't like it. I'm with
my
Emily
husband
on this
hates
one.
Green olives. He won't like it. Like if I order that, he just won't eat the damn pizza. So I, yeah, I know people who will not, and I know other people who feel likewise because I'm like, what do you have against the olives? They're delicious. So yeah, that's probably my controversial take.
That's a good one.
Fair enough. I'm sorry. All right, what? What is your favorite scientific word or phrase?
Do I have to know the meaning of it?
No.
What about syzygy? Is that a word?
Syzygy is a great word. It's a great word. Yes.
Okay, good. That's syzygy, mine,
for folks listening who are not familiar, syzygy is the alignment of planets and suns and moons. So basically, when there is a solar eclipse, we are seeing a syzygy between the sun, earth, and moon.
Yes. I thought it was a rash. I'm sorry. But your definition is better.
This is awesome. What is your least favorite scientific word or phrase?
Oh, least favorite.
Oh, God, it has nothing to do with space, but probably purulence.
Purulence.
Yeah, purulence, like, you know.
Pussiness? What is that? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pus.
Scientific word
of
phrase.
It has nothing to do with space, but it's not a word you really want to hear or see ever, because that usually means something disgusting. Like, yeah, okay.
No.
The reason why I say this is because I actually watch, okay, I'm a loser. Here's where it comes out. I watch the Zip Popping channel sometimes.
I love that Dr.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Yes, I love her. And I'm fascinated. Like, if I honestly had not gone into what I do, I probably would become a Zip Popper for a living. And they always say when they have like a boil, they're like, and you see the purulence here. And I'm like, that's disgusting. I hate that word.
So, yeah. My camera's off, and I am nodding so intensely right now.
We were talking about sandwiches and pizza. Now we're off in some horrible thing.
Well, she brought us there. Our questions were in there. She started it.
No, that's fine. If you,
but y'all, if, that is a disgusting scientific word.
If Emily, if you want to be in another lifetime a professional purulence popper, that is perfectly acceptable.
Of course, I'd want to wear like a shield, you know. Yeah.
For sure. Okay, next question. What is your favorite? What is your favorite useless science fact?
Useless science fact. Oh my god. I don't know that I have a useless science fact. They're all pretty useful, aren't they? I mean, this is a pro science
I think so.
Show, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pro science, but there's some goofy ones. Like, yeah, I guess
we weave all these facts together, and we end up with a beautiful tapestry. So they're all very useful, I think. How about I'll that? Accept that.
Sure. Yeah. No.
There are no useless facts.
All right, accepted. If you could rename one planet in our solar system, what would you call it?
Uranus needs a better name just because it gets made fun of so much.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because it gets trolled so dang much. It's really a beautiful planet. It's like that beautiful greenish color. It's on its side. I don't know what I would call it other than, it's like an aqua. It's like almost like an aquamarine or a topaz or something like that. Maybe something jewel toned. I have no idea.
Is that its Greek name, and maybe there's a Latinate cognate that we could call it instead? I can't, it's not a god. It was a type, wasn't it? Wasn't Uranus a type?
Yeah, I think so. It's just because it gets made fun of so much, and nobody wants to talk about it in school because it has an embarrassing name. You don't want to say it in class.
Right. We can get away from the whole.
Whenever I post an article on science actually about Uranus, I get all the comments every time.
Correct. I think I posted something in Space Hipsters once about it, and it got like 600 likes, and it was just lols. And I was like, no, this is it. And of course, the headline was something terrible. Like, I don't even want to repeat what it was, but it was a serious article, and it got the likes for the wrong reason. So
yeah, of course we'd be depriving the nation's fifth graders of some comedy gold that used for generations
true.
Now. But yeah, it might be worth it.
Okay, so you change Uranus to something funny. Still funny, it has to be. Cool. okay, last question, and you can both answer this one. If you had to sing one karaoke song to save humanity from an alien invasion, what would it be? It could be a duet as well, if the two of you want.
I would sing When the Ship Comes In, that old Bob Dylan tune that the Decemberists just re-recorded. It's such a great song, and I have no idea what it's about, but I really love it.
I'm embarrassed. Bruce has such a poetic answer. I'd probably sing the Pina Colada song, the fight song I'd probably sing that. Because I know the lyrics, and it's like the dumbest song ever. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's pretty horrible. Actually, it's about a dude cheating. But I'd probably sing that. Sorry.
No, there are no wrong answers. I mean, our guest last week answered "Twinkle Twinkle Little Star." That was her answer. So there are no wrong answers. This is a good. Round.
Right on.
Those are hard questions, guys.
Yeah.
But they're fun.
Yeah, they're fun. Yeah. I agree.
I had to dig deep.
It's like a dating game or something, you know? Now we really know each other.
Well, yeah, now that all of our listeners and watchers have heard these dating game answers, where would they be able to find you on social media if they wanted to reach out to you?
I'm on Facebook, and I participate in the Space Hipsters conversations fairly often. And I've got a website, www.brucemccandless.com. And that's really about it. I mean, I'm not super active. I don't do any Twittering or anything like that.
Fair enough.
I'm on, pretty much every social media except X. I'm on Space Hipsters on Facebook. I also want to give a shout out on Bruce's website. I believe he has a lot of the notes for the book on there. We didn't have an index in the book because the book was kind of very extensive, but we have sort of our notes and some source notes on his website. So I want to point people towards that as well if they'd like to learn more about the sourcing in the book.
Good point. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Awesome.
Very cool. Benjamin, where can the good people find you?
Please look up Science Actually on all the social media platforms. Facebook is the biggest, but also you can find on Instagram and Threads, and I don't think Hive exists anymore. I know I keep saying that, but Mastodon is a fun one. And if you want to watch this show, please go to TikTok or to YouTube. You can see us, or you can see me for most of this episode. And
folks can find me on all the good social media platforms and also the bad ones at Fun Fact Science. Feel free to reach out to me or to Benjamin. And tell us what you want to see and hear on future episodes, additional topics, questions, quibbles, queries, other dating questions. And this has been great. Thank you both so much
thank
for your
you both
time.
For taking the
yes,
time.
Thank you. Thank you.
This was fun.
I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Wonderful. Yeah. All right. We'll see you all next time on the next episode of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
The issue here is monkey. What? Us. We are the monkey.
What Gus is saying is that we're missing the point. What Gus is saying is that we all heard the rumor that they want to send a monkey up first. Well, none of us wants to think that they're going to send a monkey up to do a man's work. But what Gus is saying is that what they're trying to do to us is send a man up to do a monkey's work. Us, a bunch of college-trained chimpanzees.
Fucking A, Bubba.
All right, so what Gus is saying is that we got to change things around here. He's saying that we are pilots. And we know more about what we need to fly this thing than anybody else. So what we have to do is to alter the experiment. And what that comes down to is who is going to control this thing from here on out.
What Gus is saying here is that we got to stick together on this deal.